Good morning, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Consensus or Controversy. As this morning, we talk about the management of hepatobiliary cancers, and we have a great faculty today. Dr. Ahmed Kaseb from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, and Dr. Arndt Vogel from the Princess Margaret Cancer Center in Toronto, Canada. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by the faculty, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we do with all of our webinars, we put in a one-minute pre-meeting survey in the chat room. And also after the program here tonight, if you take that, you'll get a lot more out of the meeting. Well, we're finishing up this week now. We, of course, the last two nights, we're doing programs here, doing programs in the GI Symposium. But next week, we'll be in San Francisco again for the GU Symposium, this year back-to-back. So next Thursday, losing track of time here, we'll be doing a big program. Same format we've been using in ASCO GI, and we're going to do right now on prostate cancer. And then next Friday night, we'll be talking about urothelial bladder cancer. So much going on there. We can continue our webinar program. We're doing our year in review program on January 30th on breast cancer, a program on myelofibrosis on February 1st. And then while the entire weekend of March the 22nd to 24th in our hometown of Miami, we have 31 investigators joining us. We'll be talking about a whole bunch of cancers. If you can't come to Miami, it'll be all online. We know a lot of people end up listening to our programs. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program we did on biliary tract cancers. But I'm really excited and looking forward to this program for a while once I saw the lineup for the GI symposium, because there's actually a pretty interesting, well, I would say fascinating paper that was presented yesterday. And I'm really thrilled to be able to have the opportunity to talk about it the day after it gets presented. We'll get to that in a second. Just a reminder that we are going to be talking about unapproved uses of medications. Consult the package inserts for these agents. As we're doing for all these meetings in GI and GU, I work with two investigators to plan this next hour, and we're actually going to do two webinars. We're going to do another follow-up one in about a month and maybe follow up on some of the things we're talking about here today. But I work with Dr. Tom Abrams from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston and Dr. Stacy Stein from the Yale Cancer Center. And I recorded a lot of questions and comments, and we're going to show some of them today and some in our second webinar. Here's where we're heading. We're going to start out talking about HCC, and then we're going to talk about biliary tract cancers. Dr. Kaseb and Dr. Vogel both have very brief presentations that will review some data. But first, we're going to take a look at some of the videos. But let's talk about EMERALD-1 that just got presented yesterday. You know, Ahmed, I have this thing our audience knows, like my favorite trials of the year. And last year, I didn't get to one that really hit my fancy until May at the AUA meeting, the EMBARK study. And we started to see other trials that really caught our attention. I didn't think we were going to be finding a trial like this so early in January, but here it is, and this is major. I think, you know, maybe not so much in changing that the natural history of HCC, it's just another step. But for people in practice, this is major, major news to figure out. We're just going to, you know, put our foot in the water slightly and give you a taste of what we're going to need to deal with over the next few weeks, because investigators are ready to go and apply this data. We need docs in practice to at least know about what happened here. So, Ahmed, this is really an amazing study. To me, this is, and I first looked at this, you know, TACE with either Durva or Durva and Bev, I didn't quite get the fact that in a way, this is like bringing Atezo-Bev earlier, except it's not Atezo-Bev, it's Durva-Bev, so very similar combination. But the paper, again, that was just presented yesterday, and the fascinating design here that they gave just, say, have three arms. The Durva, they only gave Durva during the TACE. After the TACE is over is when they added the Bev in, and suddenly that's when they started to see more benefit. But here it is, PFS 0.77, 15 months versus 8.2 months. I think the point was made, a lot of the, I guess a lot of the PFS events might have been, you know, hepatic dysfunction related? Because I guess that, you know, and there's issues there also in terms of when the scanning was done. And then we did not see any benefit for the DERVA alone, which I think was very interesting. So Ahmad, wow. And I'm wondering about how this is going to translate into clinical practice with the interventional radiologists and medical oncologists trying to figure out what to do. What's your initial thought? Are you ready? Would you like to be able to use this strategy, Ahmad?
Yeah, so yes, this is very significant news, Neil, for two reasons. One is, as you mentioned, it is a validation of this concept of anti-VEGF and checkpoint inhibitors in HCC in a different stage. So we already have approval with atezolizumab for advanced stage disease. This is intermediate stage disease. So it's a validation of the same concept in HCC, which is great. Number two, it also fulfills an unmet need for this population, especially those patients who have multifocal disease and they have to go through multiple rounds of tests. So in my practice, I think this is the patient population that after approval would really benefit from this regimen.
So aren't curious about your thoughts about this strategy. And do you think that people are going to be thinking about, you know, this strategy for everybody who gets TACE, or more selectively, maybe people with, single site disease, or, you know, really good response to TACE, or is everybody, you think, going to be at least considered for it, aren't?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. And I mean, first of all, I agree with Ahmed. It's a very interesting study. It's interesting, as you pointed out, that DOVA alone did not add, and BEV make the difference. You can see it also in the PFS curves, right? Curves are separating once BEV kicks in after 4 months. Yeah. In contrast, in the IMRAVE 150 study, curves are separating immediately, similar to the adjuvant study. So it's really something about the BEV that adds efficacy here. To your point, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think we need to get some more granular information. Does not mean that I do not think that this study could be practice changing, but I think it would be important to get more information. And we know that there are some TACE eligible candidates that get a great response with TACE alone. And I'm not yet sure whether really all patients require TACE, but specifically those that have multiple tumor, larger tumors, not the perfect candidates for TACE, certainly will get it, and I think they should get it. The other point, when you look at the subgroup analyses, there was not really a subgroup that suggested that a specific group would not benefit. So, I mean, this will require a lot of discussion also in the tumor board, who will get it. It's not a clear picture that somebody does not need to get it, to be honest. If at all, the subgroups were very small. I think this is something we really need to look in a little bit more detail and get some more data.
So Ahmed, one of our favorite oncologists, John Layton, especially very interested in GI cancer, asked about this same strategy with radioembolization. You know, a lot of people think maybe radiation therapy potentiates IO. We know in lung cancer you have Pacific study, they saw a great benefit. Now there's a cervical cancer study post chemo radiation. Any thoughts about that strategy, Ahmed? I'm guessing there are tons of phase 3 trials of other IOs coming down the line we're going to have to deal with maybe soon. I don't know. What's going on, Ahmed?
Yes, so historically, patients with multifocal bilobar disease were either have to go through multiple tests, or more recently, specifically in the U.S., since 2021, yttrium-90 has been approved, and people are been using it more and more. So if you look at the same concept, it makes sense. However, there are ongoing studies, multi-center randomized studies. So we're going to have the definite answer soon. It is legitimate to think about it, but I would not use it yet with Y90 until we have the data. Because for now, if you have a patient who is undergoing multiple tests, this could be the right population for it after formal approval.
So, in terms of IOs in this situation, Dan in the chat room wants to know, do you think is there any evidence that we're curing out of these people by, moving the IO up earlier? Any thoughts? Are we seeing, 5-year survivals like you see in some solid tumors, trickling up to 20%? any kind of sort of similar hints that we maybe could even be curing HCC?
Yeah, excellent question. And I think this is exactly the point we need to think more about in the future. And of course, these patients that are candidates for TACE were deemed to be in the palliative setting. Yeah, I think having now more option extending PFS will definitely push the median overall survival. Again, for the study, we need to wait for more mature data. But I think it's a very valid point and something what we really need to discuss and think about in the tumor board, downsizing, downstaging of our patients. So if they are not deemed resectable, when we get now great responses, when we put everything in TACE, BEV, IO, everything, in 40, 50% of cases, we get great responses and we need to get more information about the deepness of response. But I'm very sure that some of these patients will be candidates for resection or maybe even transplantation. Yeah, something we also need to discuss and consider. And that could mean cure indeed. So, and that would be really a big change.
So actually, another thing I was sort of thinking about last night, actually, we had a patient, a patient with MSI high who got, HER2 positive, who got an IO. And after the first dose of IO, the patient had pneumonitis. And I was thinking, TACE, Ahmed, is not necessarily a benign procedure. People can get fevers, et cetera, et cetera. I wonder if there's going to be an issue of identifying, symptoms and issues that occur if you got IO at the same time, separating out what's from the TACE and what's from the IO. Is that going to be an issue, Ahmed?
Yes, and that's why we need some more granular data from this study, because exactly as you mentioned, now you have a patient who just underwent the first TACE, and then after that, shortly after, you're starting immunotherapy. So, and especially for those patients with multifocal disease or large tumors, they could suffer post-embolization syndrome. And with the emergence of immunotherapy, now we've been using it for 6 years in HCC, we've learned a lot about the correlation between adverse events and underlying liver disease and cirrhosis. And this study allowed B7 patients, so patients who are early child PUB. So we really need to know more about the adverse events that they encountered, especially in the first 3 to 4 months, where you see a lot of events on the curve. So once we get to learn more about the tolerance, quality of life, it's going to help us apply it to practice.
So another one of our favorite oncologists, Priya Rudolph, in the chat room and says, so hopefully this will encourage better coordination with IR and MedOncs. And yeah, it's going to be need to be absolutely done for sure. All right, let's talk a little bit about HCC. Ahmed put together a great talk reviewing that, but we want to talk a little bit about taking care of patients first. Here's a comment from Dr. Stein. Arndt, I'd like you to listen to this and tell me what your thoughts are. Here's Dr. Stein.
There's always a question that comes up at every discussion about, do we think that there's a difference between patients with hepatitis B, C, and non-viral, or these metabolic syndrome patients? We're all seeing more metabolic syndrome patients, right? That is kind of the future. And, they tend to be older. They have a lot of comorbidities, and nobody has been screening them for HCC. So I think overall, they tend to present later because they're not getting liver cancer screening. And so, do we know? None of these studies were really meant to prospectively say, are the patients with metabolic syndrome responding differently, right? And how so? And how should that be affecting the treatment decisions? We don't know. So we're giving everybody the same treatment.
So Arndt, I think it was Stacy who told me that MASH is the new NASH. So it's metabolic, not non-alcoholic. I don't know how many are picking up on that MASH one, but any thoughts about that, particularly this issue of responsiveness of treatment in viral versus non-viral to IOs, Arndt?
Yeah, that's a very important question. We had some very controversial discussions on that. I mean, first of all, we need to state that we need to better define the non-viral group, because as you have said, we have now MASLD, the metabolic associated liver disease. We have ALD, the alcoholic liver related liver disease, HCC, and we have the group in between. So a lot of patients eat and drink too much, right? The MET-ILD, which have both as a risk factor. And they have not been really distinguished very well in the clinical trial. They're more like no good biomarkers and anything. And again, the degree of cirrhosis is also different. So it's a mixed bag. And with that, it's very difficult to understand the data truly and to draw any final conclusions out of that. Yeah. The question is, does any of them does not respond? I do not think. I think we do not should base our decision making on the underlying liver disease. If at all, I think we can conclude that hepatitis B related HCC may respond a little bit better to IO checkpoint inhibitors. But overall, we should not base our decision making at this point in time on the underlying liver disease.
I don't know, Ahmed, whether Dr. Allison has any theories about this, but so, you know, when we first heard about IOs, I was expecting that people with viral-induced illnesses would have higher response rates. We didn't, like head and neck, you don't necessarily see that.
Yeah.
Any thoughts about this question, Ahmed?
So there are some, you know, as Arndt said, you know, the studies were not powered enough to show us, you know, this differential outcome. However, there are emerging data about the subset analysis that give us some hint. So, for example, in some, a lot of these studies, actually meta-analysis was done a couple of years ago that showed that in general, viral-related HCC benefits the most, while non-viral-related HCC has got, you know, lower outcome measures. And then you see some papers coming out from preclinical space and biomarker space that showed some correlation with specific PD-1 positive, CD8 positive cells that correlated with resistance in NASH-related HCC. It is not yet to a point where we can use it in clinic, but there are some subset analysis that are suggesting this hint, viral-related benefit better from immunotherapy. However, one caveat here, if you combine anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 with anti-CTLA-4, you don't see this. So dervatrimi, for example, patients benefited equally non-viral versus viral. Hepatitis B a little bit better, but non-viral, when you combine nivo-epi or dervatrimi, you see some overcome of this resistance.
All right. Well, let's cruise through a few other key questions here. This is certainly one that we've debated a lot in the last couple of years, choice of first-line therapy. Sounds like things might be moving up earlier, so a lot of patients may not get to this point a couple of years from now. But here's where Dr. Abrams and Stein are on this very controversial question.
My feeling is that the necessity for an EGD kind of makes it a little bit easier to start dervatrimi. I think in general, the fact that you're getting combined checkpoint inhibition for one dose only, and then the rest of it is just a PD-L1 inhibitor, I think that's attractive as well. You know, Bev has its own set of issues associated with it. And also the 4-year survival data for dervatrimi seems pretty interesting. What are your preferences and how do you make those determinations since you have two, you know, fairly similar regimens with fairly similar data?
You know, the gold standard right now is that every patient be treated first line with an immune therapy combination. Atezo-Bev, you know, has been the gold standard a few years. Then we have durvalumab and dervatrimi with the STRIDE regimen. And, you know, it's always interesting to hear from people in different places how easy it is to get an upper endoscopy. A lot of the questions that often come up are which regimen to use. You know, we have some published data for Child-Pugh B patients with atezo-bev, but we don't have that data yet for dervatrimi. And when you're in real world practice, the majority of the patients, at least that I see, really are Child-Pugh B. The risk of adverse immune-related events requiring high-dose steroid use was about 20% with dervatrimi, which is not insignificant, and it is lower, you know, with atezo-bev.
So, and I guess the other thing before I ask Arndt how he thinks through outside of a trial setting, choice of first-line therapy, when she referenced the 20, or I've heard even 25% requiring steroids, I mean, that's a lot less than ipi-nivo, which is more, you know, in other solid tumors, more in the range of 50%. But still, I think point is very well taken. So, Arndt, what's your magic sauce about how you approach this question? You give everybody atezo-bev, except people who have contraindications of Bev, or are you more interested in dervatrimi?
Yeah, so I think I'm open for both regimens, and I think they both made very valid points. I think the good thing is we have options now, right? And we can look more closely to our patients, and we can base our decision making on the patient profile. Yeah, it's not only contraindications against IO, and I agree that with Astride we do have more IO related side effects, which we also do see in the clinic. But we also have contraindications against Bev, right? And so with that, and I think the question about liver function, liver cirrhosis, and decompensation is also very valid. So I think we really need to look very closely to our patients and then decide which treatment. I agree a little bit with Stacy that the majority of patients at the moment still get atezo-bev. We have more experience with that. But I also agree that dovastatin is a very interesting option. The long-term survival data are very compelling. So definitely two very valid treatment options.
So one more question, then we'll move on and talk about biliary tract cancer. And this is something we talk about anytime we talk about IOs in general. But then the setting, you know, really does change things a lot, which is a relative or absolute contraindications on med to immunotherapy in the HCC setting, and particularly the issue of people post liver transplant. Here's Dr. Stein.
I have had some patients that had recurrences after liver transplant. I have not treated any of them with immune therapy, and I usually will just put them on lenvatinib then and kind of go through the tyrosine kinase inhibitors. In patients with autoimmune disorders, I think you really have to, you know, be very granular in thinking about what is the autoimmune disorder and does it really serve as an absolute contraindication. As an example, I just had a patient that's starting treatment this week who has a history of MS, and I was very hesitant to start IO therapy. So actually, we kind of pushed the local therapy over the last year and a half, maybe more than we would have for another patient. And then I spoke to his neurologist just recently. And, you know, this patient has had relapsing remitting, has not had a flare in a while, is not currently on treatment, does use a cane for balance, but he really wants to try IO therapy, and his neurologist felt very positive about trying it. So after, you know, large informed discussion, he wants to try IO therapy, and we're going to start.
So Ahmed, one of my favorite cases in lung cancer, we heard at the beginning of the pandemic, Dr. Polkin, who I remember in Maine, had a patient with MS who had lung cancer, ran out of all options, saw several African opinions, very astute person, treated her, no problem, had a great response. It turns out PD-1 was zero. So I always use that as the possible hope in this situation. Of course, it doesn't always work out that way. I don't know if you've ever, you know, heard of or seen of a patient who's lost their liver. It's a horrible, terrible thing to even think about, Ahmed. Any thoughts about this issue about who you hold off on IOs, Ahmed?
Yes. So I use two major principles. You know, one is if there is, you know, some need for medications, especially many medications, you know, polytherapy for autoimmune disease. So if you have a patient with history of rheumatoid arthritis and they're already on two medications and steroids, 20 milligrams, I wouldn't use it. But if you have somebody with a hint of maybe history, then I consult the specific disease specialty. And then we do it in tandem. You know, I get a tag team. And a lot of times, I would say more often than not, they actually work with us to allow us to start using it, and they follow the patients closely. So I would say do it in a multidisciplinary manner if you have to, if you really want to get better response. And in that case, make sure that you have the specialty, the other specialists on board to help you taper up or down, you know, the steroids and the other immune suppressives. Post-transplant, I would avoid it because it's really high risk. Unless it's in a clinical trial, I wouldn't do it because we do have tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So if somebody has no contraindication whatsoever to any immuno, I would do atezo-bev because of the survival data, PFS, and response rate. So this is kind of, you know, how I practice.
So actually, I was thinking whether I dreamed this or not, but I think it actually happened last night at our symposium on colon cancer. We actually had a case, MSI-high patient, metastatic disease, ran out of options, who had a heart transplant. And they gave the patient IO, and the patient was fine, responded. But, oh, my God, I could not believe that case last night. I thought I dreamed it. All right, money out.
If you don't have any options, you think about it.
And, you know, obviously the patient has to be deeply, deeply involved, but still it doesn't make it any easier. I just can't imagine what it's like as a physician to have to, you know, deal with that. But anyhow, let's just quickly go through these so you can check out the entire survey. We're going to talk about it more in the next meeting we're going to have. We're going to ask about Emerald too. We'll get some more data since we hadn't seen it when we asked this survey. Just a couple quick things. I'm going to run through these and just ask each of you if you have any comments in general about that. So, you know, our way of doing consensus is we ask people what they do in their practice outside of a trial. If they all do the same thing, we call it a consensus. If we see a slide like this, we say, well, it doesn't look like there's exactly for sure. It looks like there's more than one evidence-based option. I think Arndt's summary of the situation is depicted beautifully, and particularly by Katie Kelly, who's just saying, I just can't tell. Here's some other scenarios. We were curious what it takes to push people one way or the other. So we said grade one varices with beta blocker, but still, I think before Dervotremi, people would have maybe treated, but now that you have Dermatrevi, it looks like people moved to that. We presented an older patient with child abuse of B7, PS of 1. Interesting. Why do people think, well, I guess maybe Derva alone, but most of these people say Dervotremi, Ahmed, what do you think?
Yes, why? And that's, you know, mainly for this patient population, there is actually a subset analysis of the Dervotremi, the Himalaya patient population that looked into the child pew subclassification using the LB score. And it showed that even with higher grades of LB score, meaning poorer liver reserve, the results were, you know, holding, and also the patient population tolerated it. So there is evidence from the Himalaya study that even for patients with borderline liver function, they still benefited and they tolerated it.
So again, you can check these out after the meeting. We ask people when they use, think about Dervotremi more, and all the issues related to Bev come up. When we ask people to compare, obviously indirectly, efficacy of the two regimens, again, kind of pretty much get the feeling very, very similar. Tolerability also, you see, actually some people say one, some the other. Actually, it looks like maybe people think Dervotremi might be more, which is kind of interesting. We asked about this strategy, a patient who gets atezo-bev aren't up front, and then maybe this is going to be an issue. We're going to be saying patient gets atezo, well, I guess it'll be derva-bev with taste, and then they have progression. I guess they're going to be getting second-line therapy and the possibility of bringing anti-CTLA-4. Ahmed, before you go through your talk, aren't any thoughts about that last issue? Would you maybe bring in, if a patient, would you bring that, try that strategy, Arndt?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting and compelling, and it may not only be a CTLA-4, it may be also any of the other combinations with, for example, lenvatinib. And as you know, we have the IMRAV-251 study, which exactly looks at this question. So can we continue atezolizumab beyond progression, so switching from atezo-bev to atezo-lenva or sorafenib? And I think it's a very valid question. The study is recruiting very well, and hopefully we will get soon some data, which will be extremely important, because now we are moving the IOs in the earlier settings, and we really need to think more about sequencing and whether we can use and how we can use the checkpoint inhibitors in later lines, in second and third line setting maybe.
So Ahmed says he could do this talk in 8 minutes, but if you do this talk in 8 minutes, Ahmed, I'll get you a ticket to the Super Bowl, which incidentally, I think maybe you're Houston Oilers. I mean, they're playing this afternoon.
I know.
They're looking awful good. I'm wondering if they're going to be in the Super. What do you think, Ahmed?
I know. We're all rooting for them. It's a very, very high peak. You know, today is a tough day for them, but you should never write them off.
Yeah, it's going to be an awesome game today. All right, let's get back to HCC, Ahmed. Go ahead.
All right. Good morning, everyone. So today I'll be talking to you about the optimal utilization of immune checkpoint inhibitors as frontline therapy for advanced HCC. So two major pathognomonic features in HCC really help us charter and help us understand how to manage and also understand clinical trials coming out in any stage in HCC. Very quickly, one of them, angiogenesis-driven tumor, VEGF-mediated, and the other one being an immunogenic tumor because of the chronic inflammatory cascade, no matter what the risk factor is. So these two factors really dictate for us the prediction of response to therapy, also prognosis, and also explain why every single agent approved in HCC will have to be in either one of these boxes. So we're going to learn about the standard and evolving systemic therapies, get into key factors affecting selection of first-line systemic, and then get into regimen-specific factors affecting efficacy and safety, and then discuss sequencing and real-world data. So this is what we have. The green boxes are the approved indications for HCC. So we do have in frontline, sorafenib, lenvatinib, atezobev, durvalumab, and then we do have a positive phase 3 study with camrelizumab and rivoceranib, which is anti-PD-1 and tyrosine kinase inhibitor anti-VEGF. And then in second line setting, we have rigo, cabo, and ramucirumab, and then we do have nivolumab, which was retracted by the company, and then we have nivo-epi conditional approval and pimpro conditional approval. So let's move quickly to talking about factors affecting selection of first line, or in another way, can we ask this question? Do we have response predictors of systemic therapy in HCC, such as biomarkers, risk factors, demographics, or liver function status? So a meta-analysis years ago looked into this concept from all randomized studies of sorafenib, and then it concluded that hepatitis C patient population benefited the most. And this could have at least been partially related to the fact that hepatitis C patients have underlying portal hypertension, and sorafenib had a beneficial effect on the portal hypertension and underlying cirrhosis. And subset analysis of recently reported pivotal phase 3 studies showed a hint towards preferential outcome in hepatitis-related HCC when it comes to immunotherapy. So this is the COSMIC 312. Overall, this study was negative for OS. However, if you look at the hepatitis B patient population, very significant difference in terms of PFS and even OS in this population. And then we see the same thing with pimpro plus lenvatinib, better outcome in hepatitis B, at least, you know, if you look at the subset analysis here compared to non-hepatitis B population or non-viral. And then if you look at all randomized controlled trial, this is a very important meta-analysis that showed that across the board, patients with viral hepatitis benefited the most and as compared to patients with non-viral hepatitis for immunotherapy clinical trials. And then, of course, ramucirumab has got an indication for patients with AFP more than 400. And then Himalaya study, if you look at the patient demographics here, so there was similarity in terms of ECOG status, baseline AFP and liver function studies. However, there was some difference in terms of high risk features in the proportion of macrovascular invasion patients and extrahepatic disease between both arms. Himalaya study, for example, also had some patients with main trunk portal vein thrombosis VP4, while IMbrave 150 trial excluded them. And of course, as we all know, IMbrave 150 mandated upper endoscopy within 6 months before therapy. So the answer to the first question, AFP more than 400 is an indication, a label indication for ramucirumab. There is a hint towards better outcome in sorafenib in hepatitis C population and immunotherapy in viral hepatitis HCC. And there is a hint to better outcome based on subset analysis of the cabo-atezo study and pimprolen in hepatitis B, and use caution when it comes to borderline liver function status and main trunk portal vein tumor thrombosis. or varices. And then moving on to the regimen-specific factors now affecting efficacy and safety. So this is very interesting. If you look at the anti-drug antibodies for immunotherapy checkpoint inhibitors, you see here some discrepancy between one drug to another, atezolizumab being the one with the highest incidence of anti-drug antibody positivity. And if you look at the correlation between this and the outcome, as expected, you see shorter PFS and OS in patients with high anti-drug antibody. And then nivolumab, ipilimumab regimen, the Achilles tendon here, because it's a combination strategy. Immunotherapy, the immune-related adverse events, 46% of patients needed steroids, actually, or close to 50% when it came to immune-related adverse events management. And then Camry-Revo, this is a positive study just published in Lancet. I worked with Dr. Vogel on it. So it's Camry-Revo, anti-PD-1, anti-VEGF drug, strong positive study in terms of OS, 22%, 22-month, and also response rate and PFS. And we see a little bit difference in terms of the adverse events could be reflective of the strong anti-VEGF effect of the Revo. So we're going to learn more and more about this as we start using it after approval. And then special interest, adverse events of special interest for IMbrave 150 here, I'm pointing to increased liver function studies like AST, for example, and bilirubin, also skin rash, hypothyroidism. So we're going to also be seeing more and more of this with the emergence of immunotherapy, not only with the durvalumab in frontline, but also in intermediate stage disease after approval, such as the study we saw yesterday at the ASCO GI with the Emerald One. And then finally, with the ALBI grade, looking more granular into the child pew classification here, this is a study that looked into atezobev divided by the ALBI grade and showed that patients with grade 2 plus ALBI, they had lower response outcomes, while in durvalumab, both patient populations responded and he had the same benefit was holding even for higher ALBI grade on durvalumab. And then the 4-year, this is an updated 4-year overall survival for the phase 3 study with the Himalaya, showing that the effect is still holding over time and there is still separation of curve even 4 years beyond. And then finally, last section here, talking about sequencing and evolving real-world data in advanced HCC. So the bottom line is upfront, if there is a contraindication to immunotherapy, we are left with targeted therapies and TKIs, lenvatinib, sorafenib in frontline, Rego, Cabo, Ramu in the second line. And then if you look at patients who don't have contraindication to immunotherapy, the field is wide open. Atezobev, durvalumab, sorafenib, lenvatinib in frontline, and then second line, do have Rego, Cabo, Ramucirumab. And then if patients who never had any immunotherapy still could have options with immunotherapy in this setting, Pimpro and Nivo AP are still approved and Nivo was retracted. And of course, you know, some considerations here, getting EGD upper endoscopy for patients to assess their varices and risk for bleeding and anti-angiogenesis, and make sure that you follow the liver function status very closely in patients with borderline liver function, specifically child pew B patient population. And as a general consideration, in the absence of trial options, assess demographics and risk factors as we spoke about. And then this maybe is just very quick. Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe we can, I want to be able to have enough time either. I know you got a couple more slides here, but maybe we can move on and people can check out the slides afterwards. I want to make sure we have enough time to talk about biliary tract cancer. There's also some things coming in the chat room that I guess it was Camry-Revo. I don't know if that's the new lenvatinib-pembro. It looked like it was a lot of hypertension there. Is that a big problem there, Ahmed?
So we see this in drugs with very strong anti-angiogenesis. And in fact, some studies, not only in HCC, but in other diseases, showed a correlation between this effect and response rates and survival outcomes. So in my mind, in clinic, I really try to control the blood pressure before I even start anything. And ACE and ARB, ACE inhibitors and ARB, are the best classes to do this in anti-angiogenesis. We learned that from bevacizumab era.
So Vincent says there's a study from Mass General suggesting aspirin can prevent HCC from MASH. That's pretty interesting. Lillian asks a very interesting question, Arne. I've never really thought about this. Can you omit EGD for Tezobev for HCV patients who don't have cirrhosis?
Yes, for sure. I mean, it's really for patients with portal hypertension. And if they do not really have advanced cirrhosis and also indirect signs of portal hypertension, like low platelets, big spleen, and stuff like that. I mean, you can think about omitting it, but you need to be sure, of course, that they really do not have an underlying cirrhosis. So if you have any doubts, you should talk to your hepatologist, but it's definitely possible.
So good question, Lillian. All right, let's talk about biliary tract cancers, and we're going to go back to our consulting faculty. And of course, here we go again. Now we've got a couple of choices, or sort of two choices as first line therapy. Here's Dr. Stein.
When you have similar data between two regimens, the one that is approved first and published first often kind of becomes the standard, right? So I think most people have a lot of familiarity with giving Cisgem and Durva, although there is the Pembro data. So that's in the KEYNOTE-966 study that was basically Cisgem with Pembro. And, you know, the criteria were slightly different, but for the most part, very similar study. You know, so that is another option. I think the question really is there any reason to kind of choose the Pembro regimen over the durvalumab regimen?
Is there?
Not as far as I could tell.
So aren't any thoughts about the choice of IO and other than people with contraindications, is that a standard of care, one of these regimens?
Yeah. So, I mean, we discussed before, I mean, we have now options. Is it Dovatremi or Atezobev? In colon cancer, we are talking about FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, right? So now here we are talking about Pembro or Topaz in combination with Gem/Cis. And I think the most comparable is most likely Topaz and Keynote. I mean, these are different drugs, right? But outcome is very, very similar. And I think everything is academic discussions. And for decision-making, we don't have any biomarker who would suggest that either drug is more effective than the other. So both are valid, very valid options.
So another issue, and I'm curious about Ahmed, how he approaches first-line therapy. But first, I'd like you to listen what Dr. Abrams said about more specifics about how, what specific regimen and schedule to utilize. Here's Dr. Abrams.
Not everyone's going to handle the chemotherapy well. I think in particular, the way that Gem/Cis is delivered can be challenging for patients. Days 1 and 8 is not very easy. And so for my elderly patients, I almost always will start with a dose modification and see if they can tolerate it and then move up if needed. Because when it was just Gem/Cis, if you were elderly, I almost always started you on days 1 and 15. I sort of, you know, stretched it out. And I thought that that was much more tolerable. And it didn't seem to have any effect on outcomes. But with the Durva being in there, it's harder to do that because you give it every 21 days. Although I think it's not unreasonable to give Durva every 28 days either, but I haven't been doing that. So I think it can be a fairly toxic regimen.
Any thoughts, Ahmed?
So I do the same exact thing, which is day 1 and 15 of Gem/Cis, modified dose, and I do Durva every 4 weeks. And this is because I see a lot of HCC patients. I'm very comfortable with Durva every 4 weeks. So this is my strategy for all patients, to be honest, not only elderly, because very few patients can handle the Gem 1,000 milligram per meter squared day 1 and 8. Even in the study itself, a lot of patients had to have dose reduction.
So I want to touch a little bit into targeted therapy. We could spend all day long talking about it. I like to joke around that biliary tract cancer is the new non-small cell lung cancer, because you all seem to be getting into similar in terms of targeted therapy. But I'm curious, Arndt, how you think through the workup of a patient who presents with metastatic. I mean, obviously, you have different sites of biliary tract cancer. I don't know how that affects the way you look at it. But what would you say to a general oncologist in terms of the workup, particularly in terms of genomic markers, tissue versus blood base? How do you think about the initial workup, Arndt? And what are the things that you're most interested in looking for in these patients, Arndt?
Yeah. So I think the answer is very simple. Just do it. All patients with biliary tract cancer require NGS profiling as early as possible, because we do not only have approved options in the second line setting, but we have a lot of ongoing trials in the first line setting. And you really need to know your options. In intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas, I think we can argue that around 50% of patients have druggable alterations. If you take new targets as of today into account, like MTAP deletions, MDM2 amplifications, which are evaluated in clinical trials, we have established markers like FGFR2 fusions, IDH1 mutations, BRAF mutations, you name it. So there are really so many druggable alterations that it's really absolutely required to do the testing. And I would suggest to do it as early as possible, because time is running and the prognosis of these patients is still very poor with a median overall survival. So you need to know your options as early as possible. And then it is important to discuss with your pathologist that really all druggable alterations are detected by the test you use. This is an issue we can talk about for an hour, but the take-home message is really talk to your pathologist whether FGFR2 fusions, MTAP deletions, whether they are all detected by the test. And lastly, the point about liquid biopsy, it is something you can consider, but we need to acknowledge that some patients are non-shedders. So we will never be able to detect the genetic alterations in the blood. So I would go first with tissue. If I do not have enough tissue, liquid biopsy is a very valid alternative to get more information.
So, Ahmed, I'd like you to listen to this case and comment on it. As a young patient, also curious whether there's any trend, you know, in GI cancer. Obviously, colon, we see younger people, but this is a younger patient also who actually got Topaz first line. Here's Dr. Stein.
I have someone now who's young. He's in his mid-30s, and he has an FGFR2 amplification, and he was on Cisgem-Durva. He had metastases to the back that was painful on a rib that we had radiated, and then that started to grow and signified kind of progression on first-line therapy. So he started on futibatinib and is coming up on the first scan. But I could tell, I think that he's responding and the back area has become more comfortable again. So hopefully he's responding, but we had to initiate phosphate binders recently for a rising phosphate level.
Did he have symptomatic relief with first-line therapy?
He did.
How did he tolerate first-line therapy?
Pretty well. You know, overall, Cisgem-Durva is a pretty well-tolerated regimen. Most of the patients who are very symptomatic are symptomatic from the cancer and not usually from the treatment.
So, Ahmed, I'm getting a lot of grief from the chat room because I said Houston Oilers. I forgot you guys changed to Houston Texans probably 20 years ago. I don't remember. But anyhow, any thoughts about this case? Also, are you seeing younger people with the biliary tract cancers? Is it gallbladder, you know, any particular type of cancer? And any thoughts about this case? Any situations, this is a younger patient, where you might want to use FGFR first line?
Yeah. So we do have, you know, this kind of, you know, trend over time that also early stage or early onset. We see that in HCC, but we see it also in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. And we all think that it's because we are better at diagnosing it. It used to be called unknown primary in the past, but now we do have a lot of immunostaining and molecular profiling. So we're identifying more and more. And there is, you know, a significant number with early onset. So in general, I usually try to start with GemCis immunotherapy, Durva or Pimpro, and then save the molecular therapy to the second line. And I usually, I'm like Arndt, I also do the tissue. I rely on the tissue unless we can't, and in which case I look for platform that could have some evidence of druggable targets from blood. So I do liquid biopsy if I cannot do tissue, but I start with GemCis Derva.
So I want to show you a couple of things from this survey, but we're getting some cool questions in the chat room. So Arndt Zinn says they have an 82-year-old patient with stage 4 cholangiocarcinoma. The GFR is less than 50. What would your first-line therapy be, or how would you approach first-line therapy?
Yeah, this is a valid point, and we do have a couple of elderly patients with impaired liver function, and I mean, this can really do harm here. So I think the platinum has really a role in cholangiocarcinoma, and without platinum, it has an effect on efficacy. So it's a discussion I have with the patient, either switching to Gemox, as our French colleagues do it also frequently, with oxaliplatin, I see less kidney toxicity. And if you're still concerned, you can even go with gem monotherapy, but this is not what I really would recommend. I really prefer to have the platinum for our patients.
So Vincent in the chat room, we're going to go back to this faculty and ask him about Emerald. But when I do, I'm going to also ask him your two questions, which we're not going to have time for, but I love the questions. How do you treat mixed tumors, mixed HCC and cholangio? Great question. Should all HCC patients have tissue biopsies? We'll talk about that in the next one. But Ahmed, we do these things where we go, tell us about the last patient in your practice just to see what people are doing. It's like a cross-section. So we said last patient in your practice who got the Topaz type approach. You can see the ages. There was one patient younger, 34 years old, but most older patients. And this is the way people are thinking through first and second line therapy in people without targetable mutations. Even with IDH, in general, people are using that second line. And FGFR, same thing, second line. As you can see, different preferences in terms of the two agents that are available. Well, we've in other form, we spent the whole hour talking about HER2-positive disease, but like many other cancers, we're seeing a little bit of activity, or maybe a lot of activity, with TDXD. Arndt, before you get into your talk, just kind of curious, have you used TDXD, the antibody drug conjugate, in any patients with biliary tract cancer? We have seen reports of responses. Have you actually tried it? I don't know if you're even able to get it.
Yeah, we can get it. We have a clinical trial, the HERP trial, so it is feasible. We have a lot for her too. We really have a lot of options. So it's really, again, the matter of what do you choose. But I would definitely recommend to do it.
So, but have you seen an objective response to HER2 therapy in biliary?
I mean, responses are really great. I mean, so this is what we see with all the targeted therapy. The duration of response is always a little bit of concern. It's usually around 6 months. But you see really in 30 to 60, 70% of patients, you can see responses. So you get responses for sure.
Yeah, I mean, we're wondering, I wonder whether at some point maybe there'll be a pan-tumor approval in HER2, but I don't know. But you're certainly seeing GYN, et cetera, et cetera. All right, we're going to finish out. Arndt's going to go through some of the key data sets in biliary tract cancer.
Yeah, so I mean, we are running out of time a little bit. So I just give you a brief overview and basically the way how we basically introduced and got immunotherapy into BTC. This is the most recent guideline, and we strongly recommend checkpoint inhibitors as first-line treatment. And then we have all the targeted therapies in the second-line setting we have just discussed. And as you can see, molecular profiling is really at the front. This is something you really should consider in patients with cholangiocarcinoma. So when we now think about checkpoint inhibitors, first of all, there's a low prevalence of established IO markers like TMB or TMB high or MSI. So we will not find them. And in general, when we look at our patients, based on molecular profiling, we have to state that the majority is really they are not hot tumors, but cold tumors. And around 10 to 20% of patients can be considered as so-called hot tumors. And with that, efficacy of monotherapy with checkpoint inhibitor is really low. The KEYNOTE-158 study was one of the studies which evaluated that, and you can see response rate is really in the single digit. So nothing we would really pursue. So the question was, since we do not have a biomarker, monotherapy does not work, we need to head to combinations. One very interesting combination is certainly Lenva-Pembro. We not discussed it in HCC. There's a really interesting efficacy in many tumor types, including BTC. It's not yet in the clinic there, so, and there's, to my knowledge, no phase 3 trial to evaluate it, but definitely an interesting combination. Dual checkpoint inhibitor adds efficacy in HCC. We do have phase 2 data in BTC. You can read them as positive, negative. There's indication that tremelimumab or CTLA-4 also does something in BTC, which but again, the efficacy was not as good as we were hoping for. So the question was, should we just combine it with our standard of care chemotherapy? And one of the first study which evaluated that was the mini-TREMI study, combining GemCis with Dova or Dova-TREMI. And you can see here in the Korean population, really amazing responses. And this paved the way to two phase 3 studies, Topaz and Keynote. I think they are well known. GemCis backbone, slight differences in the clinical trial designs, but in each study, a checkpoint inhibitor was added to our efficacy. When you look at the outcome, it is very similar. Hazard ratio is around 0.8. In one trial, curves are separating a little bit earlier, in the other trial, a little bit later. But I think it's an academic discussion whether any of these checkpoint inhibitors would be more effective than the other. I do think both are valid options for BTC patients. We have already touched a little bit on toxicity. Overall, I think the checkpoint inhibitor does not add significant toxicity to the treatment. And you can see here the frequency of serious adverse events. And you can see they are very similar between the experimental and control arm. And this is very reassuring that by adding efficacy, we do not add too much toxicity. Of course, we do add, when we use a checkpoint inhibitor, we do add immune-related side effects. And this is an example from the Topaz studies. Nothing unexpected. These are immune-related side effects you see in any other tumor type. Same is true for Keynote-966. I think it's a very appealing illustration of the side effect. Hyperthyroidism is definitely something we do see. But as in other tumor types, when you use just one checkpoint inhibitor, they're all in the single digits, and we do not have too many grade 3 or 4 side effects. The question is, are there any patients that benefit more or less? When we first saw the Topaz study, there was a little bit discussion, do Asian patients do better? This was not confirmed, that I will show you in a minute, in the Keynote study. So based on region, I think we do not need to argue that patient may benefit more or less. Then we, of course, have the question about the anatomic location, intrahepatic versus extrahepatic versus gallbladder. I think we have a very consistent picture of efficacy. Subgroups are getting very small. And if at all, there's a tendency that intrahepatic may benefit a little bit more than extrahepatic or gallbladder. But as I said, the studies were not powered to detect any differences. And it's definitely too early to exclude any of these patients for a checkpoint inhibitor. Do we have a biomarker to select patients for higher efficacy? Unfortunately, it is similar to HCC. PD-L1 was, of course, a very valid approach to look whether higher PD-L1 expression is associated with more efficacy. There is a tendency of higher efficacy, but definitely nothing for decision making. So similar to HCC, we cannot use PD-L1 expression or to decide whether a patient should or should not get a checkpoint inhibitor. Here, again, I mentioned before, region is not a biomarker to select patients. In the Keynote study, the non-Asian patients also actually derived a slightly better benefit, so nothing we need to worry about. The question is, are there any other biomarkers we could use to select patients for checkpoint inhibitors? In the TOPA studies, they did a lot of, and an excellent job, a lot of post-hoc analyses, but there was no clinical or biochemical biomarker to select patients for checkpoint inhibitors or to identify those that might have a long-term survival benefit. Some examples are here, neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio, tumor markers, CRP, so, but they all do not really correlate well with higher efficacy. Same is true actually for genetic alterations in these tumors. We briefly touched on the high frequency of druggable alteration in these patients, which is really exciting. So in the TOPAZ study, we asked the question whether any of these alterations would be enriched in long-term survivors. And as you can see, this is not true for the majority of patients. Again, subgroups are getting very small. And what you can see on the right-hand side, there was one alteration which was slightly enriched in the long-term survivors, and this were actually patients with BRCA mutations. Yeah, and this is something we have also seen in other tumor types, such as pancreatic cancer, that BRCA mutant patients tend to benefit a little bit more from checkpoint inhibitors. Very rare in BTC, around 2-3%, but they tend to benefit more from checkpoint inhibitors, or at least they are more enriched in the long-term survivors. So with that, I'm already coming to the end, and you can see here again the ESMO practical guideline, and I think this really highlights all we need to consider in BTC in 2024 and not 2022, as stated here.
So, wow, it's been a really a great session today. Thank you so much, audience. Thank you for attending. Come on back next Thursday. You think there's a lot to talk about here? Wait until we talk about prostate cancer and bladder cancer also. Ahmed, I don't know if I told you where I'm from, Ahmed. Originally, I'm from Baltimore, Maryland. So I think you better watch out for those Ravens this afternoon. We'll see what happens.
I'll text you today after the game.
Okay, you text me. Let me know what happens with Lamar, and we'll see what happens. But audience, thank you. We'll be back next Thursday. Be safe. Have a great weekend. Okay. Thanks so much, Arndt. Thanks so much, Ahmed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.